Hello, welcome to Under Another Name. I wasn't quite sure the recording had started there. Episode 3.
I think you forgot the name of the podcast, James.
Under Another Name.
Okay.
That's the name, isn't it?
It's a name, yeah. I just thought you forgot it.
All right, okay. So this week we're going to be talking about two things. So we've had protests across the country, and these have been going on for a few weeks, right, in response to the Police and Crime Bill. Bristol has been very much in the news. It was in the news last night because of very disproportionate measures used by the police. And it was in the news last week because a police van was set on fire and there were some smashed windows at the police station. And we're also going to be talking about upcoming elections. So as we know, in May, there are going to be local council elections, mayoral elections, devolved assembly elections, as well as a by-election in Hartlepool, and also, very exciting, police and crime commissioner elections, Joe. Did you know they were still going on? Because that's all it's all we can vote for here. I looked it up the other day. So I'm going to vote in a police and crime commissioner election, having lived in London for a very long time and didn't get the opportunity. This is going to a very boring place. So let's start with what happened in Bristol over the weekend. So I became aware of this, obviously, as we all did, on social media. And what I saw was a peaceful protest. So you had images of protesters sitting on the ground, and police were there were lots of police with riot shields, you know, just standing around. And then a few minutes later, all hell broke loose. And that was not because of the protesters. It was because the police had a plan, which was to disperse the protesters using force. And what you ended up seeing was the police using truncheons, riot shields, horses, dogs, batons. And I was disgusted by it. But that was not the response of everybody. So I've struggled to sleep last night. I was up quite late. And I did expect when I got up rather late today in the afternoon. I expected maybe some outcry. Maybe I was a bit naive. And what I got was Annalise Dodds on being interviewed, basically. What did she say? Can you remember what she said?
It was along the lines of, you know, this isn't the right time to be doing these kind of public protests.
We should quote her, really, shouldn't we, if we planned that bit.
Yeah, but it was that.
And nothing from Keir Starmer, and then I read one BBC report when I got up, immediately after I got up, and it was, I would say 70% of it was just parroting whatever had been put out by the police in Bristol. And the other 30% was them quoting Annalise Dodds. And all over left-wing Twitter, you've got people, you know, from my perspective, telling the truth of what happened, which is that it was seriously bad policing. So that's the first topic. I've gone on a lot about it. Now, obviously, I'm not happy about what happened because it suggests that that people look at the use of police power in a very different way to how they look at violence if it's done by protesters. And the reason for that is, whereas in my mind anyway, protesters are sort of automatically delegitimized in the minds of lots of people just by being a little bit noisy and I don't know, holding up signs in an anarchistic way, however you want to describe it. Whereas the police are automatically sort of the good guys, and the media essentially only really focus on protest if it does go violent. They only seem to focus on the violence of one side. When a police officer, I mean, there is a video out there, literally, of a police officer smashing a woman in the face with a riot shield, which Aaron Bastani tweeted around, which was absolutely disgusting. And yet the whole narrative around this is just appalling. I'm not very coherent about this, but that's where
yeah,
I am on this.
I think it was shocking to see some of the videos from the protest in Bristol last night, and I would encourage people to go and have a look at them. I think the plea that I want to make when you're thinking about talking about protest is the plea of context. So we need to understand any public political action as sitting within a wider context. So part of the context for what happened in Bristol last night was the protest that had happened also in Bristol the week before, which James mentioned in his introduction, where we did see a police van set on fire. We saw violent confrontations between police and demonstrators. We saw some very violent use of the baton by policemen. We also saw demonstrators smashing windows. So that was part of the context. And I think it was important because there was a real sense, I think, of reprisals last night, that this was essentially the police letting those who were out in the streets know who was really in charge. And they're encouraged to do that, because when they deploy this kind of violence, and it is violence, they're cheered on by the government, the Prime Minister, the Home Secretary, but also almost all newspaper editors of major broadsheet and tabloid papers, and of course the opposition party, the main opposition party in the UK. So those things are really important context for what happened in Bristol. What's also important context is that there is a bill going through the Houses of Parliament which is seeking to quite explicitly take away from protesters the most basic rights to be able to like organise and manage a disruptive political event. Now, that's really important, because at the point where you're saying protests can happen as long as they're not disruptive, and I know we spoke about this last week, but I just want to re-emphasize this. At that point, you are really saying protest can't really happen in any meaningful form. So then at that point, I think it's worth just taking a step back and looking a little bit more carefully about what's going on here. So, you know, if we go back to Bristol last week, what did we see? We saw quite kind of almost stage managed like images and like scenes of disorder that were all conveying this one very clear message to people, that the violence is out of control. It's time that we dealt with this. Enough is enough, etc. So the optics of it were very carefully calibrated. And you'll remember, I'm sure, that we also heard about a number of policemen who had got broken bones. I think broken ribs were mentioned. And then, of course, quietly it comes out this week, none of those injuries actually occurred, right? None of them happened. And this is well-practiced stuff from the police. You portray the violence in the most graphic terms on the night, and then afterwards, people have moved on. You've got to quietly admit that maybe things didn't quite go that way, but it doesn't matter by that point. You've already fixed the image in the public mind. So my view is that this is all quite carefully done. And as somebody who continues to oppose the Police and Crime Bill and doesn't think that what took place in Bristol has any bearing on whether I should continue to protest it, particularly given, by the way, that the powers the police already have are perfectly sufficient to deal with violent protests. There's nothing in this bill that meets that or that responds to those particular pressures. Although, of course, Conservative ministers were absolutely happy to go on the radio and the TV and pretend that the policing bill was necessary because of the kind of things we'd seen in Bristol last week. And so, as I say, that's the context that brings us to the scenes we saw last night. The police virtually acting with impunity as the sun went down in Bristol against demonstrators who, at some level, within public discourse, they almost, I think this is not quite overstating it, they almost lose their humanity. You know, there's a point at which people just say, ugh, who are these horrible, smelly people standing in front of police stations, singing their silly songs and their chants? Why don't they just get stuffed? Why don't they just go away and stop being such a problem And good on the police. Yeah, that good on them. Get the batons out. You know, drag them away.
Well, sometimes more than that, isn't it?
Yeah.
You see on Twitter, you know, oh, they should have water cannons. They should lock these people up.
Come up, yeah.
And let's be clear about what this is about. Because the other thing people are saying is kill the bill. They're pointing to the sort of, I saw a tweet saying, do these people understand what kill the bill means? Because protesters, Joe and I were outside of the police station in Brighton today protesting about the bill. Obviously, if you're standing outside of a police station saying kill the bill, you're going to have people misconstruing that, because obviously it doesn't mean, you know, we're not saying that we should be killing police officers. We want to kill a particular bill in Parliament. And let's be clear about what that bill does. It says that you can face 10 years in prison if you are part of a protest that essentially is deemed to be a little bit noisy or a little bit threatening in some way. And it also is horrendous in terms of what it does to traveller communities. It essentially means that police have powers in relation to traveller communities to make their ways of life impossible by essentially moving in if they're causing bother to people nearby, which is obviously appalling. So, you know, it's taking away the right to protest. It is targeting a particular group of people, and taking away their rights. So this bill is a very authoritarian measure. And if we lived in a normal country, or indeed if we were looking at another country from the perspective of good old liberal Britain, if we were looking at these scenes in America or in Hong Kong or wherever it happens to be, we'd have the Home Secretary, as indeed she has in the past, condemning the violence of the police and saying that people have a right to protest. So it's a strange thing. And the other thing I'd say about, and I've said this a few times, I don't know if I've said it on the podcast, it was obvious today on the Brighton protest that the protest was going to be peaceful, at least up until the point where we left. We left just before nightfall because that seems to be the point where the police start to change their tactics. What did we do? We gathered in a park. It was quite disorganized, as these things often are. Some people decided they were going to take a lead, and so everybody followed. We marched through the streets, chanting various slogans. We ended up outside the police station. We continued to chant slogans. There wasn't a massive police presence. We were being filmed. There were some police vans there. There were some police sort of blockading the entrance to the police station. And then essentially that continued for about an hour. I decided that I was quite hungry and quite wanted to have a cup of tea.
Yeah, we're not.
And so
we're not the revolutionaries we like to present. But, you know, I think it's important our listeners do understand that. And it's not because we're like, I don't know, we want to strike the right balance between, protest, but also, you know, respect for law and order. We're just old and tired.
We didn't even have a cup of tea.
No.
And I hold that against you.
Yeah, well, James, you're holding a lot against. I feel like, you know, you're cranky today.
We
might come back to that.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm cranky. I'm cranky because the politics of protest requires hope. Mm. And the feeling I have is that whilst protest is a really important part of democracy, right? And I'm going to be protesting at least whilst this bill remains something that is a realistic prospect of being passed, and indeed just about the authoritarianism of this government in general. But, if you look at slides to authoritarianism, usually a slide towards authoritarianism can happen in circumstances where the government of the day feel like they have support of sufficient numbers of the public. So in this case, Boris Johnson's Conservative Party have a plurality support amongst the public. About 40% of people will support this government no matter what, if you believe the polling, and a lack of opposition in Parliament. And that is what you have. And I think it's a really toxic mixture. Yeah. And Keir Starmer's not going to do anything in relation to this because the pollsters are telling him, the people around him on the right of the Labour Party are telling him that in order to get elected, he needs to be tough on law and order. He needs to be tough on crime and the causes of crime. It needs to follow in that Blairite mould. And so we've got a totally neutered and silent opposition from Keir Starmer for strategic reasons, an emboldened opposition.
Government.
Government, that's what I meant. Yeah, yeah. You know, and they're emboldened to even lie about it.
Yeah. And they do, and they frequently, you know, as I say, they tell a story about what the bill does that plays into the optics that we've already talked about on the news, because they're in people's, in, you know, the minds of the audience, but it's got nothing to do with actually what the bill proposes to do. But I want to talk a little bit more actually about, you just mentioned about the attitude of the leader of the opposition. And you're right, the people around him will absolutely be saying, you know, yeah, the British public do not want to see, you know, the leader of the opposition kind of saying anything negative about what the police might be doing or speaking up in favour of protesters, etc. There's something I think that needs to be said at this point, which actually just goes beyond, you know, the particular questions or the debates around that specific strategy. What the people around Keir Starmer don't understand about the way politics works now in the internet age is that people can see how the trick is done. So you can say all these things. We need to make sure the public understand that we're tough on law and order. But the public already know that that's what you're saying. They already get that this is an optics game. We don't. The politics of like the 1990s, I think, were that you could still have people like essentially having private conversations about politics. You could have the kind of like broadsheet newspaper editors and leading politicians kind of all talking to each other and saying, oh, this is the kind of thing the public want to see. But you could kind of keep the public out of those discussions. You can't do that anymore. The public are participating in those. And so it doesn't work. Because people know what the agenda of Keir Starmer is. Keir Starmer's agenda isn't to support the police or to support protesters. His agenda is to get elected as the leader of the Labour Party, leader of, as the Prime Minister. And you don't want people to see you in that light. You don't want people to see you as someone who's just doing and saying whatever is necessary to become Prime Minister. But we all know that's what Keir Starmer's doing. So I think,
and it's also what Boris Johnson's doing.
Yeah,
but Boris Johnson does it better.
He's better at it, and that's the second thing I wanted to talk about. So here's why Johnson is better, right? Let's now. I talked about context. Let's talk about this bill for a moment. What is this bill trying to do? Let's make this clear. This bill is not about addressing specific issues the police have in dealing with protests. That's not what this bill is there to do. This bill is there to align in voters' minds, you know, those voters for whom law and order is a major concern, is to align the government with that. And even better,
The viewers can't see just how much Joe is gesticulating. You're getting a bit shouting.
Okay.
It's okay.
I hear that. All right, I'll wind it down.
And we're in a bubble, by the way. Just
we're so bubbling.
I can see Joe because he's sitting next to me.
Yeah,
we're in a bubble, but he's gesticulating so much that I feel like he's about to knock something off the table.
Okay, so
back to your point.
Back to my point. It's a good point. It's an important point. I accept the need to, you know, I think that was a worthwhile interjection, James. I'm going to just try and take it a notch down. I really want to make this point. So, what's the bill there to do? The bill is partly there to get people out on the streets. That's great as far as this government is concerned, because drawing those lines in society, getting people to look at their TV screens and say, ugh, look at those horrible, straggly hippie protesters. We're not like them. Who's against them? Oh yeah, Priti Patel. Fantastic. That's the person we want to see as Home Secretary. In other words, the bill, its real effectiveness is to draw out those kinds of tensions within society so that the Conservatives can position themselves in the right place. And a lot of people say, well, Labour are in an impossible position. No, they're not. The leader of the Labour Party should be calling it out. The leader of the Labour Party should be saying, they shouldn't be saying like, oh, what do we do about this police and crime bill? We can't do this because then the public will think we're too soft, but then we've got a problem to our left. Some people, you know, stop doing that. Call out what the bill is. Call out what the Prime Minister is doing. That's your job. This endless optics paranoia has already driven Labour into the ground at least twice in the last decade. The Brown calamity of 2010, the Miliband era is a sustained example of why optics politics will just, you know, always end in disaster for Labour. And it's extraordinary to me that they can't see this.
Right, but I know you want to get on your hobby horse and
I'm on it
and bang on about Keir Starmer. But the point that this bill reveals to me is just how fragile our democracy is, because what all you need to do if you are a nationalist authoritarian government, which this government is you need to galvanise the support of around about 40% of the people around a particular agenda. You win a majority in Parliament, and then you're able to marshal that majority to do whatever it is that you want to do, which in this case is taking away our liberties. So, you know, it's incredibly serious what's going on here. We have a government who are using plurality support amongst the public in order to push through measures which are taking away hard-fought-for rights. And so the strategic considerations are important if you're within the Labour Party, but the reason why there are so many people out on the streets, particularly lots of young people, is that this is serious stuff that's going on here. Now, I want to move the conversation on because we talked about a lot, and we talked about this a lot last week when we were talking about protests, and I don't want to bang on about this a lot. But look, if you're sitting there listening to this podcast and you're not already sold on the idea that this country is in a very dangerous place, just think about for a second what the point of protest is and what protest has achieved in the past and why we've needed to have protest in the country. And have a think about what happens when you have a government in power with an 80-seat majority, with the plurality support of the public, and an opposition that aren't opposing them. That means they can do literally whatever they want. They've got a media that are willing to support them in doing that. This is really dangerous. It's not, you know, we're not crazy here.
Yeah.
It is dangerous to have a situation like this. And Keir Starmer, absent any other consideration, has a role to play in the history of this country. And it might be as a gullible fool that allows our hard-won rights to disappear. I want to move on to the Hartlepool by-election. And what do I have to say about this? Well, there is a Hartlepool by-election. The MP stood down. I've forgotten his name. Completely forgotten his name.
Great, is it?
It doesn't matter. So Hartlepool. Hartlepool, just for context, it's right near where I grew up. It is a northeastern seaside town. It has always been Labour as a seat. It used to be, for example, the seat of Peter Mandelson, one of the architects of the New Labour years. And there's going to be a by-election there because the Labour MP, whatever his name is, stood down. I can't remember his name. It's not that.
You can't, I can look it up.
He's not a big hitter, is he?
No.
He's not a big hitter.
No, but he was definitely under a cloud of, you know, allegations hanging over him.
So why does this by-election matter? It matters to me because...
seemed like you were going to ask me that.
I wasn't. It matters to me because I was at the first Hartlepool by-election in 2004 as a Tory. And George Osborne didn't buy me an ice cream in Hartlepool. And if anybody that knows me will know that I my hatred of George Osborne started very much earlier than most people's. That was when I was a Tory. I'm obviously not a Tory anymore. Why does it matter now?
It's important to realise that James can hold a grudge really, you know, to levels that surpass most human comprehension.
Multi-millionaire George Osborne.
I'm not here to shill for George Osborne. Quite the opposite, but of all his, if we're listing his many crimes and misdemeanors and failures as a politician, I don't think not buying you an ice cream ranks particularly high.
But it's worth bringing up that by-election for other reasons, because when I was walking around Hartlepool wearing a blue rosette, I mean, it was like, it was totally alien territory for the Tories back in 2004. It was their worst by-election result ever. They came in fourth place behind UKIP. So it was Labour, Lib Dem, UKIP, and then the Tories. And, you know, the idea that we were fighting a losing fight. I mean, Michael Howard came down. I remember I went to shake his hand, but I, you know, when you try, you got, I'm always being socially awkward. I was holding balloons, right?
Oh, okay, okay.
And I had to shake his hand with the wrong hand.
Oh, God.
So I ended up with this sort of, Michael Howard put forward, hit the right hand, and I put forward the wrong hand.
Yeah.
And there was this sort of really awkward sort of slippery mess in the middle.
Yeah.
Between me and Michael Howard.
It's not what you want with Michael Howard.
It's not what you want. He did have very cold hands. I don't remember that he had cold hands.
This is why you listen to this podcast, right? This is the kind of gossip that you're here for.
I can't remember.
Michael Howard.
I'm just making it up.
Very cold hands.
Anyway, right, so why does it matter now?
Sue us, Michael Howard.
It matters now because there's a narrative that's developed around the 2019 election, that Labour lost the election because they lost a certain sort of voter in the so-called Red Wall.
Do you want to say who that voter is in the kind of typical conception? I think it's worth saying it.
Why don't you say
it? So I would assume we're talking about socially conservative, this kind of caricature of a Red Wall heartland voter. I mean, really doesn't go much further than that, does it?
Working class,
socially
white.
Conservative. Yeah, it is white, and it's actually also male.
Yeah,
I think if you and actually it's of a certain age. It's sort of like 40s and above. So it's actually a bit more. There's a kind of stereotype,
and there's something real behind that.
Yeah,
I mean, it is true that if you look at how the demographics of voting have changed, and we've talked about this a lot, you're more likely to be a Tory. The older you get, you're more likely to be a Tory. The fewer qualifications you have,
and therefore, if you're
going to construct a stereotype, it would look something like that.
Can I just add, you're also more likely to be a Tory if you're male.
Yeah,
which is quite interesting.
Yeah, so that sort of caricature is real. It sort of exists. And the point is, if you wanted to construct an electoral test for Keir Starmer, conceived on his own terms, because his sort of strategic position is that he should stay on the left economically. He's not doing that because he's an idiot, but he should do that. And the sort of blue Labour figures in the party are saying, stay on the left economically, but move to the right on social/cultural issues. And that actually would make some sense. And were Keir Starmer actually doing that, then it would be an interesting test. What Keir Starmer is actually doing is basically saying nothing apart from pointing to a flag every now and then and talking about how much he likes the army and stuff. That seems to be the strategy. And basically, very long-winded this bit, isn't it? The test for Starmer is, can he hang on in Hartlepool or is this going to be actually the tip of the iceberg? Because I think one of the things that people don't realise about the Red Wall, so-called Red Wall, is that there may be more of it to fall to the forces of Boris Johnson's Brexity authoritarian nationalism.
So, yeah, that's right.
Brexity authoritarian nationalism.
I love that you just rolled straight off the tongue.
Yeah.
It's interesting you recount your days as a conservative activist. I don't think we shouldn't tire of repeating that you were a true blue Tory back in the early 2000s, and you were there traipsing the streets of Hartlepool as the party dropped to fourth place. I'm not sure how much of the credit you can take for that, but we'll gloss over
the youngest person there.
Yeah, by some distance, I'd imagine.
Not in Hartlepool, in the Conservative Party.
Yeah,
I would have been about 19.
Oh my goodness. You're making me think of William Hague's speech at the Conservative Party conference when he was, 16 or something. You were in that sort of ballpark. Anyway, let's park that. So the question, or the problem that you raise there, is how have the Conservative Party gone from fourth place and out absolutely nowhere in a seat like Hartlepool to being, you know, potentially quite likely, I think the bookies seem to rate it as about 50-50, to actually take the seat. Now, the first thing then we need to look at is, well, what was the vote? What was the, how was the seat? How did it fare in 2019? So, of course, Hartlepool, strictly speaking, of course, isn't a Red Wall seat, because when people talk about the Red Wall, they tend to be talking about the seats that Labour actually lost in 2019. They sort of like bunch them all up together. But James is right. We don't know yet exactly how many of more of these seats might be in play. And the big factor in Hartlepool, of course, there was a massive Brexit Party vote in 2019. So it's my turn to forget a name now.
It's about 10,000 for the Tories.
Yeah, but there was a particularly high profile figure in the Brexit Party.
Richard Tice.
Tice stood in Hartlepool.
I'm resisting the urge to swear after I say his name, because he's pretty odious character.
Yeah, he's not a pleasant guy. There's
a
gloss over
that. Sort of Bond villain.
Yes.
I imagine there with just stroking a
Tice.
Cat.
Yeah, okay, no, we're not going to do that. Anyway, so Tice came second. But that vote, the Brexit Party vote, is evidently going to crumble. And the question is, where does it go? Does it split 50-50? Do a lot of those Brexit voters say, OK, we got Brexit done, go back to the Labour Party now, particularly because Labour Party seem kind of more reassuring with a leader like Keir Starmer, we can go back to them? Or do they say, no, actually, you know, we've done the gateway drug. Yeah, it was nice. We like that. Let's go for the real thing. Let's have the Tories. The Tories basically are the Brexit Party in government now. I sometimes point this out to people. If Nigel Farage had been sat down looking at the 2017 Parliament, and someone said to him, "Pick your government, off you go. You choose, Farage. Who's going where?" You pretty much have the government we've got now.
I mean, we do have a test case here in Hartlepool. If you go on the Wikipedia page, there's a nice graph that shows that in 2015 UKIP did quite well in Hartlepool. And in 2017, the UKIP vote split between Labour and the Conservatives, or it seemed to anyway.
And that happens quite a lot, even in 2019.
So it's wrong to think that just because you've got a UKIP-y Brexit Party sort of vote, that is going to all go to the Conservatives. It's certainly not going to. The question is, how is that vote going to split? And if you just look crudely at the mathematics of the seat, it's going to be very, very close.
Yeah.
I don't know, what do I think?
Well,
I had to say right now, I'd say Labour would just about hang on to it.
I think there are some massive unknowns that are in play. I think I don't as yet know what it is Labour think is going to draw an ex-Labour voter back into the fold. I don't know.
Not being Corbyn.
I think that is it. I think that is their conception of it. And I think that's a problem. I think the last thing I said, I sort of said it partially in jest, but I did mean it, the gateway drug point. At the point where you've stopped voting Labour, the tribal pull that says I'm a Labour voter is already starting to be diminished. Now, this is where I go back to what I said before about Starmer and the perception that he doesn't really stand for anything, that he's someone who's really just there to try and just to sort of say what it is he thinks the public wants to hear. Why would you bother with that? You've got the real thing. I don't get why you'd bother. Why would you? Why have Coke Light? You know, you can just...
You're talking to a man that compulsively drinks Coke Zero here.
Yeah, well, you know, yeah, you, I mean, you, yeah, I think you're proving my point in some way that I can't quite fully understand. But so there's no, the Labour Party almost like literally refuses to make a substantive offer to people. It's beyond the point now of just like hedging it and, you know, being cautious. It feels kind of pathological. Like we literally refuse to promise you anything. Please vote for us.
You're back on your hobby horse.
Well, it's quite extraordinary to watch. No, I mean,
hobby horse sign.
Okay.
I mean, the point is that we've got new parties breaking through. Mm. So we've got one of the things that's happened, certainly on social media recently, is that we've had the emergence of the Northern Independence Party, who, as we speak, have got around about 33,000 followers on Twitter. Their leader has been interviewed on Navarra Media. And the party's been profiled in the New Statesman. And so there seems to be at least online, a movement building around this party. And essentially the party's position is that there is something distinctive about the North, culturally and historically, which of course is true. You had, if you go back far enough, the Dane Law in the north of England, and therefore it developed quite significantly different cultural traditions which have persisted over the generations. As a northerner, I can tell you that we haven't forgot the herring of the north and the layer of ash that was left behind by the Norman conquest. Anyway, and so the argument is that the north have always been poorly treated by a political class that are centred in the south, in particular in Westminster, and that the only way that can be resolved now is through northern independence. They say that they're not, you know, a nationalist party in the traditional sense, and in particular they're not because they are self-described democratic socialists, and so what they're wanting to do, or as I understand it, the argument goes, look, Scotland's probably going to become an independent country, Wales is probably going to become an independent country. If that happens, we're left with a Tory-dominated England. We in the North have got a different set of priorities. We've got a different political set of traditions. We've got a different cultural set of traditions. And we're not going to put up with continuing to be dominated by a plurality of voters, most of whom are in rural areas of England in the South. We are going to break away and we're going to create a society where we can put our priorities first. And that looks like, to them, to the Northern Independence Party, looks like socialism. Now, the point here for Labour is that there are parties like this emerging on the left, including the Northern Independence Party, but also including parties like the Breakthrough Party, who Joe and I are both part of at the moment. There is another one
we're not going to mention them.
Are we not going to mention them?
No.
Can I mention what their logo looks like?
Yeah.
Then people can.
Yeah, they can.
It's like a little white bird on the mm-hmm. on a.
Yeah.
It looks like a the background looks like an anarcho-communist flag.
I think I am right in saying that the party in question do have an anarchist sympathies.
Right.
But let's gloss over that. So let's just pick up what you're saying about.
This is not going to help us when we come to trying to cooperate with them in the future.
Hey, listen. They're not going to listen. It's fine.
They wouldn't have got this far through the podcast.
I hope not. I mean, God, if anyone, I mean, can we just say at this point, yeah, like if you're still going at this point, wow, well done. Like, okay, I'm now going to talk about the Northern Independence Party. So this might be your cue, you know, to just to give up. But I'm going to try and make it interesting. So I'm not going to talk about the, you know, James has done a good job of explaining what their political program is. And, you know, I'm not going to waste time talking about the feasibility of that. It's not what's really in play here. The James has already said what's interesting about the position for Labour. It's also really, really interesting to watch the emergence of a party like NIP. So there's a question of like, is there room for a party like this to make a kind of splash? And what would a splash look like? It would probably only be winning 3-5% of the vote, right? So I think it's quite interesting on Twitter. There's quite a lot of hysteria building around this party, I would say. There's a bit of a sense of like they could win this seat.
Yeah.
And you know, you've seen people putting money on them, and then bookmakers have quite opportunistically made the point of like slashing the odds on them, so they're down to like 20-1, which of course they do to get attention so that people then put more money on them. Yeah, this is all pretty overblown. Now, it's possible, right? It is possible that in a by-election, sort of anything's possible, actually. But we all, you know, the realistic point to make here is there was a poll that I'm ashamed to say took me in for a couple of minutes online this week, and it put the NIP on 5%. Now, I saw that and I thought, my God, like if they're getting 5% in a poll now, they're in. This is on, right? Because that's going to grow big. You're going to start seeing lots of media attention come on them, etc. And I, you know, I feel slightly foolish that I was taken in by that. But the point I want to make is 5% would be a great result. I mean, I doubt 5% of the people in Hartlepool have heard of them yet. Now, that will grow over the next few weeks. I think because of the way in which the Northern Independence Party have been clever in presenting an offer which is really, really distinctive and unusual. We're not used to talking about Northern Independence. Not used to talking about Northern Independence.
Helpful, just yeah, for okay. context. Yeah. If we go back to that by-election in 2004 that I was part of, because by-elections have a tendency of bringing out smaller parties to contest the speech. Does anybody remember the Respect Party?
Yeah.
Led by George Galloway?
Yeah.
I was just getting flashes in my mind of seeing the Respect bus driving through Hartlepool.
Mm.
They got 572 votes in the Hartlepool by-election in 2004, or 1.8%. So I would say anything above 2%.
Yeah.
Is pretty good.
So you're a politics geek, James. I think you'll know the answer to this. What do you need to keep your deposit? So
5%.
So Northern Independence Party, like all the other parties standing in Hartlepool, would have paid £500.
Yeah.
Also, because it's a by-election, you'll see lots of parties standing because it's an opportunity.
The SDP, for example, have already paid their money.
That's right. I think actually it's possible the party that we didn't mention earlier, there's also been a bit of talk that they might be in the game. Breakthrough Party, which James and I are both members of, are not participating because we're spending a bit more time building up our
and also we believe in solidarity really with NIP. They've obviously got the best chance of winning the seat, and therefore I think even if we were at the stage of putting candidates up, we would probably say it's not a seat that we think we've got a better chance of winning. We're also a Democratic Socialist Party, and so off you go. Let's see what you can do.
So I agree with you. I think 5% would be a great achievement. But I also don't think it's impossible. I think we're potentially looking. I think this is where maybe we can start to draw some of the threads together from today. We're potentially looking at, in Hartlepool, we're seeing maybe a little microcosm of how things might go for the next few years. Is there scope for parties on the left to really make their voices heard in mainstream politics? Yes, of course, you already have notionally progressive parties like Labour and the Liberal Democrat Party. You have the Green Party. But in some sense, all of them look, at least from my perspective, like parties that are not really committed, particularly on the economy, to anything resembling transformative change. And I think especially for young people, James and I have spoken about this a lot, and they're, you know, the particular conditions around rent, around the precariousness of work, etc. These are things that a lot of parties just seem to have totally on the left, they just seem to have totally vacated that field. So what could happen in Hartlepool is you've essentially, you know, you've The thing that maybe we miss in some of this Red Wall discourse is you've just got a lot of people who are pissed off. You know, it's not necessarily they think Brexit's great or even that they're like stridently socially conservative. They're just pissed off because this is where the NIP are right. They have just been neglected for years and years and years. And that's not going to change. And I don't think people are going to necessarily be believing conservative rhetoric about levelling up. There's not much substance to that beyond, you know, a few jobs being shifted up to the new Treasury offices in Darlington. But, you know, that's, you know, it's all basically chicken feed. And I can see people looking at the NIP as a kind of bandwagon to jump on. It could be really disruptive. It could be really, really interesting. And, you know, whatever else you might say, you know, having leaders on the centre left, like Keir Starmer and Ed Davey, there's a real shortage of interesting politics on the left. And I think if new parties like NIP and Breakthrough can change that, then they will have done their job.
Yeah.
So we'll see. I mean, I don't have.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's not going to happen, is it?
No, I think that's too simplistic. Well, look, I'll just say this.
Well, let me explain.
No. Can I just say this and then you go for it, right? So I'll just make the point I always make. Everybody says it's impossible until it happens. And then it happens and we all go, oh, of course, yeah, now I... Yeah.
Shall we put a bet on the Hartlepool by-election?
No, because, because the odds are obviously in your favour.
Not a ridiculous bet. What percentage of the vote?
Yeah, I think...
What percentage of the vote do you think NIP will get?
Yeah, I think they'll get 5%.
Right, so I'll take the under on that.
Yeah.
£5?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so nice. We've just shaken on that. Well, we haven't. There we go. Right, we have. Yeah, I think they'll get less than 5% because there have been parties like this in the past. It's not unusual for Labour to be challenged on their left by left-wing parties. I was just skimming through the Hartlepool seat in particular. Socialist Labour have contested two elections in the seat. Yes, they don't have the same sort of furore around them as NIP did, but the Respect Party did. Respect Party were a party of the left led by a charismatic figure in George Galloway. So I think the issue for new parties is obvious. And look, I said the same thing when new parties emerged that I didn't agree with, right? I'm obviously in agreement with Democratic Socialist parties. I'd love them to do well. When Change UK emerged and loads of people were going crazy about Change UK or whatever they ended up being called.
I said at the time
that they're not going to get anywhere. They're not going to get anywhere because the first past the post electoral system, in order to win a seat, you have to have concentrated support in a particular constituency, and it's as simple as that. And so it's a good argument for proportional representation to point out that first past the post leaves a very large section of the population unrepresented. You know, if your politics are at the moment, if your politics are as far to the left as ours are, you've got a few backbench Labour MPs who are pretty solid. You've got Caroline Lucas. You might have some people in the SNP as well. But essentially, your politics are totally unrepresented in Westminster, and certainly you're not going to get very much done with that level of support in Parliament. And so we need to have proportional representation. And unfortunately, until we have proportional representation, let me caveat this, right? I am a member of the Breakthrough Party, and I will not vote for Labour. And the reason I will not vote Labour is they're not a socialist party. They are. So Joe, I almost interjected earlier when you said parties of the left. We don't have parties of the left.
No, I agree with that. I was struggling with my language.
I agree. I'm not voting for them. I'm really happy to support any socialist candidate. It might even end up being me that will stand.
You heard it here first.
Well, it might end up being me.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Who will stand.
It's a big moment.
Well, actually, I mean, it's difficult in this seat, isn't it? Because we've got Lloyd Russell-Moyle. And Lloyd Russell-Moyle is on the left of the party. And I guess I'll make my decision on the basis of whether Lloyd is in the Socialist Campaign Group at the time. I think he currently is. So I guess I'll support him. But it'll be very, very, very grudging support. And I will want to go to a hustings event. It might be one that I organise because it's a hobby of mine. It actually is. And ask him, are you going to side? How often are you going to side the leadership? Over what issues are you going to side the leadership? Because they're not going to win the election. They'll be in opposition with a new leader, probably to the right of Keir Starmer, unfortunately. That's how pessimistic I'm feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important.
We're going to wrap it up.
I think, look, let's just remember that James is having he's on a bad day today. I've known James much more. Hello, clouds. Hello, sky. You know, everything's going to change. I think it's important to stress that, right? It's a serious point. If you're on the left, you kind of have to go through this. You have to, you know, that's what I'm discovering, really, as someone who's relatively new to, you know, democratic socialist politics. You have to have a kind of resilience because you're going to get knocked back quite a lot, you know.
All the time.
Well, yeah.
And you're going to have bad days, right? You're going to have days where you are in absolute despair. Mm. That's what I'm feeling today. Like, you're just in absolute despair about what is happening.
Yeah.
And because I have a training in politics and I understand how politics works, I know that it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah.
And the getting better bit might only be getting marginally better because at the moment, the prospect of getting better would be maybe Keir Starmer winning in 2020. I don't even want that to happen.
Well, because I want just pause. You just pause.
I want a left wing alternative.
Yeah,
to that.
Absolutely. But so I think it's very hard not to at times to give in to that and to feel like, you know, there is nothing that can be done. And I think when you're looking at something like this policing bill, which as I say, I think is to some extent engineered to produce the kind of backlash that then actually the Conservative government can weaponize for its own advantage, because essentially this is about leveraging support for the Conservatives. It's not about dealing with crime and public disorder. And in fact, the government, they know that there is huge disorder, so a huge dissatisfaction and anger about the economy, about people's lives, the pressures people face, the injustice that exists in society for marginalized groups. And they have made a very clear choice that they're going to police that crisis. And they can do it. And that's what's so demoralizing, is they can do it because they have a whole arsenal of support that they can bring to bear on that situation through the mainstream media. The point of hope, I think, to finish on is that we're increasingly seeing that there's a large section of society that is just disengaged from that, that doesn't consume politics in the way that it has been consumed over, you know, through kind of designated gatekeepers of political discourse. And it's a much kind of freer and more, potentially also more volatile state of affairs. And that's why I think it's too easy to sort of say, oh yeah, no, there's no chance for these new parties to come through and make a difference. We haven't fully engaged with just how different this moment is. This is going to be a summer of protest. Make absolutely no mistake about that. That's not me saying that as a sort of, I've got no influence over whoever organises whatever happens in Brighton and elsewhere. I'm just telling you from the mood that's out there at the moment, this isn't going away. And I think my view on sort of like the Labour Party is it's just going to become irrelevant. It doesn't really matter, like, whether you think Keir Starmer is a good leader or a bad leader. It's just not going to matter anymore. The opposition to the government isn't in the House of Commons at the moment. You know, the opposition to the government exists on the streets. And if you're serious about opposing this government, you need to have solidarity with the people who are actually doing the work.
Absolutely. But the fact that we don't have opposition in Parliament is still very, very dangerous and depressing. And we'll leave it there. Do subscribe
to
the podcast.
I can't believe you just undercut my finish.
Sorry, was that supposed to be the finish?
I felt like that was a powerful end.
Well,
you just...
let's finish it there.
Yeah.
If you've enjoyed the podcast, seems like a small percentage chance, then don't forget to like and
you
subscribe.
You are so grumpy today.
Cheerio.
Bye.